Welcome to Elevate Maryland, a podcast with Maryland focus and Howard County roots. My name's Tom Cole, and I'm here with my guest co-host, Annie Hader-Shaw. How are you doing this evening, Annie?
I'm doing well. And I'm thinking about justice today. So I happened to be dropping off a gift at a friend's house, and she gave me a hug, and she kept saying he was convicted. And that's how I found out today that Derek Chauvin's trial is over and that he was convicted on all three counts. So I am, I feel good. I feel not happy, but I feel good.
Yeah. It's, you know, as I was sort of talking to you about in the pre-show, the jury verdicts are never fun, but this one, just the trauma that our fellow Americans, Black men and women, have had to go through in this trial. And now with the waiting for the verdict, with the video playing, with everything else, just to get this measure of accountability, there really can be little joy to be found here and maybe a bit of solace in accountability. But we do have an awesome show today. So excited to have Jerusalem Demzes on the show. She is a Vox reporter. Her articles have been shared everywhere. She is already become a thought leader when it comes to housing. And so that's a topic that we like to talk about on this show. It's a topic I care a lot about. I know you do too, Annie. Yep. So super excited about this show and can't wait to get to those questions. So why don't you go ahead and introduce our guest?
Sure. So Jerusalem Demzes is a policy reporter at Vox.com with a particular interest and focus on housing and domestic economic policy. She's previously written on energy and environmental issues for the Center for American Progress and is a graduate of the College of William & Mary, where she received a degree in economics and government. She's also the 2017 American Parliamentary Debate Association's Speaker of the Year Award winner. So I hope I never have to debate her. That's the first thing. And the second thing is she went into it on a whim, apparently. She was like, oh, let me try this out. And then she rocked it. So I never want to debate you. That's really rude. Welcome to the show.
I hear that you called my dad. No, it's so exciting to be here. I'm actually from Maryland. I grew up in Montgomery County. So it's cool to be on a Maryland podcast.
Well, I'll kick it off where, housing policy, it seems to me, and I would welcome correction on this point, but it seems to me that it is like the new hotness. Like it is a new issue that people are talking a lot more about. We've always had an issue with housing insecurity and homelessness, but in terms of focusing on the affordability of housing and the housing crisis, that is really coming to a culmination in the 2020s and maybe a little bit earlier than that. So my question to start off is twofold: is one, what brought you to this subject? And two, what are your thoughts in terms of what brought housing policy into the focus that it's in right now?
Sure. So personally for me, I was actually a senior in college, and I actually ended up reading a paper in one of my economics classes about land use policy. It was a paper by a Yale professor called David Schleicher, and he wrote a paper called Stuck. And it was about interstate mobility. And essentially, the general thesis here is that for a long time in American history, you could move from a rural area to an urban area, and you would work a job that did not require a ton of training, for instance, like working at a restaurant or working as a janitor or something like that. And you would be able to raise your wages significantly, even though there would be a rise in cost of living. That would mean that individuals would have a ton of opportunity to move to America's superstar cities, or even cities within the state maybe they were already residing in. And that would raise their wages, that would increase the amount of contact they would have with individuals of different races, of different backgrounds, of different ideologies. And on top of that, would just, you know, was just an increasing choice set for all Americans, primarily men at this time. who are able to take advantage of these opportunities. And, you know, that was a really big way that people were actually able to have, you know, economic mobility was happening in this country. And what we end up seeing in this paper is that land use restrictions, which are these, essentially, they're called zoning codes. These are the rules by which localities are able to restrict what types of housing gets built and where that housing gets built. And the proliferation of these rules becomes so overwhelming and onerous that so little housing ends up getting built in these superstar cities. Because you restrict supply, just kind of like a basic economics here, you're going to make the existing stock of housing much more expensive. Whether you're talking about these large single family homes or these condos or row houses, everything becomes more expensive. And then on top of that, we end up having as a country a much larger preference for single family homes in general, which are obviously going to be more expensive. On the same lot of land, you're only housing one family. You're also obviously going to be bigger amounts of space that you are requiring for housing one family, and other things. So what ends up happening is that over time, that person that might have moved from a rural place in New York to Newark or to New York City no longer gets the wage premium that outweighs the cost of living. So their wages go up, but the cost of living because of housing has increased so dramatically that it's almost not even worth it. Actually, it's not even worth it for a lot of these people to move to these places. And work does not magically arise, you know, to compensate for that in these rural communities. So what ends up happening is you have a generation of people, generations of people who end up being stuck. And that's the title of Schleicher's paper, end up being stuck in these places. You know, there's no economic mobility available. All of these things happen that restrict their ability to interact and engage with fellow Americans that think differently from them. You know, that they are able to bring their own diversity of thought and background to these places. So you actually get more homogenized cities as well. So a lot of things end up happening. And, to me at the time I was reading this paper, and, if you were in, post 2016, like me immediately, I was like, this explains why Trump became elected. And obviously, I think there are a lot of reasons there, but I was just so stuck on this explanation. And I started really getting into it, and my own interest in research kind of spiraled from there, looking into how much this is affecting me. And also, you know, I was just starting for the first time to have to care about rent and what would look like at some point to own a home and what that might mean for me in the future. And really just realizing how much local governments were essentially making it impossible for not just people like me, which, you know, I was lucky I got to go to college, I got to have access to a lot of opportunity in my life, but it affects other people too, and it kind of opens your eyes to that. And so I think actually my story is pretty clearly emblematic of why this is actually becoming a big issue. So housing insecurity has been an issue for a long time. There are obviously greater trends of homelessness in these superstar cities, in these states where housing has become so expensive due to restrictive land use policies. But housing insecurity has been a reality for people at the bottom of the income ladder for like generations. It's been an issue. But what is more recent is that because house prices have become so expensive and because rents have become so expensive, it is not just people who are lower wage earners who are either stuck in rural communities or are, you know, making less than what it costs to pay rent in these big cities. It is young urban professionals, people like me who attended college and expect to come out of this with a degree and able to access all the benefits that confers. And I go to Washington, D.C., and I'm being told to pay, like, I don't know, $1,200 for a room in a row house with a bunch of other young people. And, you know, that's had a lot of social forces that have, you know, angered people. Things like displacement of people, like, you know, those row houses used to be family homes. Right now I'm looking for a place to live as my lease ends. And these row houses that you can see used to be places that, you know, a family would live in are now redesigned to be like five or six rooms for you and like four other people. And I'm just trying to find a place for me and my partner to live. And you're like, why are there like five bedrooms and they all fit one bed and like nothing else? And then you're like, because we've redesigned the housing stock now to accommodate the fact that we're not building enough for families, especially for families that are on the lower end of the income ladder. So that was a lot there. So I'll let you ask another
question. No, yeah, that was perfect.
That's great. Yeah, no, we wanted to know how you got into it, because it's when I read your articles on it, there's a passion. I mean, there's definitely a passion there, and I could hear it. So that is fantastic. Thank you. So I guess, I mean, we were talking about housing supply, and that's clearly an issue, right? There just isn't enough housing supply in the areas where people do want to live, and that's become a little bit of an issue, right? So recently, I know progressive activists on the far left have developed this argument that there's this artificial scarcity with high vacancy rates, and it's maintained by developers and landlords. Is this how you see it as well, or is it? And what, I guess, is that how you see it? And is it a housing supply issue for affordable housing as well?
There's a housing supply issue for every ladder of housing, especially in the places that are in high demand. And there's enough research now to make it very clear why this is happening. This is happening because local governments are restricting the supply of housing in their areas. And that's because you look at who local governments are responsive to and who they are elected by, and they're elected by existing people, right? Like, you know, governments don't really care about future residents, and they don't factor the individual that might exist in their district at some point. They just care about who's going to get them elected in the next term. And, you know, on top of that too, we know that homeowners in general are wealthier. It's almost tautological. You'll have a home, you're likely to be wealthier. And then on top of that, wealthier folks are overrepresented in terms of their power in local government, because very few people pay attention, very few people come out to vote. And so, you know, there's research by Catherine Einstein and her fellow researchers at Boston University that talks about who shows up to these type of neighborhood meetings, where these decisions about whether a new development will happen gets made. And these are people called, I'm sure you've listened to heard of this, but the NIMBYs. It's not in my backyard. And, you know, most people generally, if you ask them, like, do you think that America should build more affordable housing? Everyone's just like, yeah, that sounds like a good thing. Like, we should have more of it. But then when you ask them, like, do you want, like, you know, the next door to you, are you okay with that house being turned into a duplex or a fourplex? They get very uncomfortable with this. And there's a lot of reasons for this. I mean, some of these are like natural, like human instincts, like people have preferences later in their life for security. We've also made home ownership so vastly important in people's lives. It's the only way that they can build wealth, to the point where, like, you know, it is like the way that you're able to retire at a reasonable age and have a life post 65 is that you're able to build equity in your house. And we've structured that in a way such that, you know, people will do anything to defend this, this asset. And as such, you know, we've had a lot of stories in America about how, you know, renters or like multifamily development, these things bring down the property values. We have these stories about how lower income people bring down property values. People are violent or dangerous a lot of the times. And, you know, I think that there's some risk whenever there's any change in your community, and people don't want to be the ones to take that on. So some of this stuff is obviously classist or racist at times, and sometimes it's just a natural human instinct. But regardless, the problem here is that we cannot be making these kinds of decisions with the interests of like 10 people in mind, or you're just never going to be able to fix the problem. That's why we have regional governments and state governments and federal governments, because there's always going to be issues like this. There has to be some place where we put the, you know, where we have to put windmills for wind energy. There has to be some place that we put, you know, an electric plant. And it cannot just be that we don't build it anywhere. And it can't just be that the people who are the wealthiest are able to hoard opportunity in this way. And I also think we need to dispel this myth that there's somehow this massive change coming into your community. I think there's a lot of good work being done trying to like visualize what increasing density in your area would look like. Mm-hmm. You know, a fourplex next door or a duplex next door likely doesn't change anything about what your community looks like. And if you were to just, you know, take all of Northwest DC and double the amount of people that could live there, that just by turning, you know, a bunch of things into duplexes and fourplexes, that could have a massive impact on housing affordability and also on social mobility when you have less wealthy and affluent people able to live near places where you see social mobility occurring, especially because the best schools are in these areas. So, you know, I think a big part of this is just it's very, very clear that the issue is scarcity. I think there's a lot of people on the left who are uncomfortable, I think, and sometimes from a very reasonable perspective, with the idea that something that could be good for developers is also potentially good for housing, housing advocates and people who are housing insecure. I think there's a rightful reason to be like suspicious when you see someone making a massive profit off of a new policy. But like, So if you look at the underlying reality here, we have to figure out a way to build a ton more housing. And a lot of times the other solutions being proposed, whether it's massive expansion of public housing, still don't deal with the underlying reality that even if you were to have a massive public housing program, you would still need to get rid of these regulations that stop people from building public housing in your neighborhood. That's a big part of it too.
So I'm going to sort of invite the third rail of these discussions, which is, and you've highlighted this many times, that it is the local government that is accountable to current homeowners that is writing the laws saying the pace of development, if any development, should be allowed at all. One thing I've really appreciated about your writing is that you've highlighted how this is very often happening in progressive jurisdictions where these people are professing these inclusive values. But is the ultimate conclusion that we need to have this power be taken away and utilized at the state level, as opposed to having cities and counties decide for themselves what their land use regulations are going to be?
I think it's really clear that the best way to do policymaking is to ensure that the body that is doing policymaking is accountable to everyone who's affected by the policy, or at least as many people as possible. When you look at the state level, state governments are very concerned with economic output. They're very concerned with growth. They're very concerned with jobs. At the very, very local level, especially if you're looking at like neighborhood associations or county level or city level or township level governments, these people are very, these are not issues that they're concerned about. It's not their prerogative to care about economic development writ large. Usually what they care about, these small suburbs, is just, you know, making sure people feel generally happy, fixing like potholes or like small things. And so the problem is there's a scale of the problem here, which we are assigning the smallest body of government that is not accountable to the majority of people who are harmed by an issue to fixing the problem. And there are a lot of good reasons to have zoning issues at the local level, that people like know the area well, they know what makes maybe make sense geographically, et cetera. But that is just an argument for including localities in the process. It's an argument for the state basically delegating all authority away. And because it's been like this for so long, early 1900s is when we start seeing zoning at the local level actually created in response to wanting to keep Black Americans out of certain neighborhoods. Is that people feel like it's so normal to have zoning at the local level, but there is no authority that any local government has that is not given to them by a state government. The Constitution gives state governments authority and it gives like national governments authority. And then within the state government, obviously there are constitutions that may delegate certain authorities to localities, but that is something that like all state governments can rescind and they have ultimate authority over, unlike with the federal government where there are certain powers reserved to the states for. So I think that a lot of times we need to like rethink about how we're doing this, reframe how we're thinking about this. Is this isn't a question of like, oh, the state government's usurping this. This is always a state government responsibility. It's like creating a department and the department's no longer functioning. We need to refix this department that is a sub-national government to the a sub-government to the state. So I think that it is correct to look at this as a state government issue that they need to be solving, and that the failures so far are also on the states to deal with. A lot of the times, it's not really state governments are we're talking about like one or two cities where there's a major problem within a state, and the state has ultimate authority to like fix that issue, and they know about it for a long time. So I mean, we can blame a lot on local governments here, but they're acting in accordance to their incentives. What's weird is that state governments are refusing to act in accordance to their incentives and fix this problem.
And if I could ask a follow-up question off of that, you raised a very important point, and this was actually raised on a podcast we had earlier about accessory dwelling units, which is that the legacy of local zoning has a racialized history. And as we are tearing down Confederate monuments and renaming public buildings, it seems as if zoning and land use regulations are given a pass, that we're looking past that. Is it fair to view these land use regulations and single family detached zoning in particular as a monument to racist policies?
I think it is very obviously the case. Like, the history is very clear here about how single family zoning and how local control over zoning developed as very clearly a part of the vestiges of racism starting in the 1910s, where we saw this happening explicitly. Until 1910, we saw it happening explicitly with, you know, people would literally write in zoning codes like, no black people are allowed to live here. And then we had racial covenants, where we had groups of people coming together and saying, we're just going to promise not to sell our homes to black people. And then, you know, into the current period now, where we have clearly economic segregation going on, which has a disproportionate impact on black and brown Americans due to a history of racism that has led them to be on the lower end of the income and wealth ladders. So that is all extremely clear to me. But I think on top of that, too, I think a lot of times not really persuasive to people to just say like, oh, this is something that is the vestiges of racism, because you could point to almost any pillar of American society and point to how it was, you know, a vestige of a racist policy or an individual who was harmful. I think what's relevant here is that it is truly right now harming everyone. Like right now, like no one is escaping the harm here. Some people may think that they're winning out because, you know, you bought your single family home in 1970 in California and now like, you have $2 million in your house, but your kids can't afford to live near you. Your grandkids can't afford to live near you. Eventually, something's going to be done about property taxes remaining so low in California, and you may not be able to afford the property taxes on your home because it's so overvalued. And I just think that, like, you know, we're getting to the point here, and I think this is why this is becoming such a heated debate, where there's not going to be anyone who's left unaffected by this problem. And even if you're an older individual, if you want to sell your house and move and downsize, you're not going to be able to find a new home that where you want to live. Like, this is a huge problem we're dealing with right now, where the pace at which seniors are leaving their homes to go live and then freeing up that housing stock for a new person to move in is dramatically decreasing. Even beyond seniors right now, because of the housing craze over the last year, individuals who could make so much money selling their homes have no idea where they would go. They can't even find a place to move into. And so we have even more people not being able to fulfill their desires for mobility, whether it's moving to a warmer locale as they retire, moving near family, or even the idea of like having your grandmother or your mother-in-law move in so that she can help take care of the kids. You can't even build a small accessory apartment on your property to make sure that can happen. You can both be comfortable in the space. So there are all these ways that we're harming everyone by doing this. And I do think one of the big things here is that even people who have defended this and defended these kinds of zoning regulations in language that is, you know, sometimes classist or racist, often don't understand exactly how these things are impacting both other people and themselves. And we're getting to the point here where I think that's really starting to change, and people are starting to understand, and there's a trickle down effect of how this is a problem. We're seeing right now, like, the idea that Marsha Fudge today, Secretary of Housing and Urban Development, was in a hearing, and she specifically calls out parking minimums and I think lot sizes as minimum lot sizes as ways that we are perpetuating the housing affordability crisis. This is language, and these are ideas that are becoming mainstream in the Democratic Party. And that's a great thing, because I think mostly Democrats are, as you mentioned, Tom, the people who are living in these places where it has the biggest effect. So if you're someone who doesn't really pay attention to this stuff, and you're nearby, you know that there's a development going up in Tacoma Park or Silver Spring or Bethesda or Howard County or Columbia, Maryland, where you live, you know, being in favor of that development is being in favor of your own economic future and being in favor of your children's economic future.
Yeah, that is great, because that is true, right? The listening to Secretary, well, soon to be confirmed, Secretary Fudge was impressive today. Like the you're right. The things she was saying were exactly what Biden was saying as well. So I guess that's and you've done a great job with covering not only before he announced what he was going to do, talking about what he should do, which I thought was impressive on for you to do. Like you like had a great range of things that he should be doing. But you've also done a good job of kind of picking apart what he has proposed so far, which isn't as much as it should be, I think. But I guess the housing component of it, tell us what you think is good and tell us what you think is missing and what needs to happen.
Sure. So Biden's big proposal right now is this grant program that he is setting up at the Department of Housing and Urban Development. And what it essentially would do is that it would give money. It was a race to the top style program. I think most folks will remember when Obama in his Recovery Act introduced the education race to the top program, in which localities are going to compete essentially for this money. And the way that they compete is by trying to outdo each other on upzoning or reforming their zoning codes to remove exclusionary zoning requirements. This is not a requirement anyway, but it is a way to incentivize people who are kind of on the fringe here to grab at this money. And, you know, state and local governments have been strapped for cash since the beginning of time, but even more so post the 2008-2009 recession, and, you know, spending never kind of went back to normal then. Obviously, they've been given a boost over the last spending bills that that Congress has passed, but these are places that, you know, are always looking for more federal funds. It is the peak way that they can engage with the federal government, is just getting this easily used grant money. And they love grant money, especially that doesn't have very many strings attached. They can use with discretion to build parks or schools or whatever they want to do. And so that's how they've designed the program. I think it's a really good idea. Emily Hamilton, who is a researcher at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University, has written a lot about how this kind of a program will incentivize especially kind of those, you know, not super exclusionary communities, but communities that are like, you know, are looking for ways to fix their zoning codes. Maybe they didn't know specifically what they should be doing, but now with this money will be pushed to do so. So that's the big thing they've started to do. There's also a proposal, and this is something that Amy Klobuchar pulled from Biden's plan in the presidential campaign in 2020, is she's announced a $300 million grant program, annual grant program, to help states actually, or help cities and localities actually get there. So while Biden is rewarding states for removing these zoning practices, Klobuchar is looking at this problem of, you know, what if a locality, especially these smaller cities, doesn't really know what they need to do this? Like, if you've ever tried to look at a zoning code, it is incredibly complicated. It's really hard to understand a lot of times what's possible. There's an entire industry of like lawyers and developers that just try to interpret these codes, and they become geographic.
What I do.
But it's just so complicated, and it's so difficult to really, even in places, even understand what is legal and what is allowed, even for people who are working in it, and what change could look like and how you would want to go about doing that. Because, you know, there are better places to put multifamily development. You would want in a place that's near transit, near a bus line. You want these to be holistic changes where you're working, hopefully, with communities near you, regional plans that you're developing, to make sure that you all are developing the way that makes sense. You know, because Amy Klobuchar saw that kind of, Senator Klobuchar from Minnesota, she saw that kind of, vacuum. She said, I'm going to create a grant program where people can apply this grant program and they can get help actually creating these plans and implementing them. So both these plans are good, but again, I think the big critique here is just this idea of the most exclusionary communities know exactly what they're doing. These are places that have been fighting change for decades. They have people who have created an entire language of opposition, cloaked in progressivism often, to say that they're not going to change, to say that they're defending the rights of homeowners, and that's somehow more progressive than what upzoning would lead to. And so those places are not going to care at all about some extra money they can get from the federal government. Often these places are much wealthier. They don't rely on federal dollars. Jenny Schutz at Brookings, she did a study that showed that the most exclusive communities in California, I think it's like 17% of them get access, even try to get this popular grant from HUD at all to begin with. And then in New Jersey, zero of the most exclusive communities even try to get this funding from HUD. So it's very clear they don't depend on federal funds, and they don't really want to do anything about it. And also, they've already left a ton of money on the table in terms of economic development and tax revenue by not upzoning on their own to begin with. So clearly they're not being very much motivated by increasing the revenues of their areas. So that's kind of one large critique. The second large critique here is this idea of, who actually is able to get access to this money, and it's, you know, people are less exclusive places are relying on it. And the really reason why that matters is because, in addition to wanting to make sure that people can live wherever they want, we also have a ton of data of where jobs are and where people want to live. We know that a lot of people want to live in the metro areas, or at least need to live because of where jobs exist in metro areas of places like San Francisco, Washington, D.C., New York, Phoenix, Austin. These are places that are growing, that have job opportunities, that have a reasonable cost of living in other sectors. Phoenix and Austin do, not the other places are very expensive. But these are places that have a lot of jobs and are attracting individuals to live there for multiple reasons. And it is important that we are allowing housing and that we're focusing and ensure that housing is built in these places, because it's not just about making sure that people can live somewhere. It's making sure that people have an expanded choice and they can live where they want to live and where it makes sense for them. So that's something I think that is important.
And based off of our earlier discussion, might it be better, and does anyone have a proposal that would, instead of focus on the locality, focus on the state and incentivize these states to, because I know just nearby jurisdictions have very different policies as it relates to what happens when a locality has exclusionary zoning practices. You know, in New Jersey, you can sue a locality that's not meeting their housing goals and does not provide enough affordable housing. So is anyone looking at the state and saying, well, while your wealthy suburbs might be able to turn down our money, you can't turn down our money, so we're going to dangle this carrot in front of you to have you change your laws instead?
Well, no lawmaker is actually trying to do that. It's already pushing, I think, what they think is politically reasonable to do these grant programs, which I think is not true, but it is further than any other president or party has gone in history to try to change these local zoning laws. And so no one is seriously at least considering changing that. But a lot of economists, for instance, Ed Glaser at Harvard, who has written a ton on housing and urban policies in general, he just was in the New York Times saying that, you know, transportation funding should be restricted from places that are refusing to upzone. And the reasoning here is not just, oh, we have this big, massive package coming out that a lot of states care about, but also transportation is intrinsically, inherently tied to housing policy. Where you live and how you can get from where you live to where you work or where you play or where your kid goes to school is important. And making sure that those things are being thought of in tandem with one another, that we are building out transit or bus lines to make sense to where people live, and that we're doing transit-oriented development is really important. And so, and it's the same idea that you just said, Tom, this idea of, you know, these states have a ton of power here, and they are abdicating their responsibility because it's a little bit politically dicey, but it is harming not just their own residents, but the residents of the entire country.
Yeah, that's a good point, actually, because there's no locality, there's no, like, within, like, I would say Howard County or even Montgomery County, if they decided to have their own little, you know, transit rail system, well, like, where would it go? To, like, one part of the county to the other? It's going to go from one county to another, right? It's going to go across the state. And so that makes a lot of sense. I think is that, and that, I guess that's the other, mm-hmm. the next question that I had sort of is that it's clear that President Biden has provided some carrots, right, to local jurisdictions. Do you think he's created enough sort of like sticks, and are there, and then on top of that, right, is it that we should be providing, should there be sticks for the state, or should there be sticks more for local jurisdictions? Like, that, it's kind of this, like, where is that then? Where is that? Where does that responsibility lie, and who should be accountable for that?
I think the best policy is to try to go to the state level here. There are obviously some places where you have blue cities in redder states where we've seen state preemption kind of go wrong. And most notably in Tennessee, we've seen them try to ban certain types of inclusionary zoning policies that could reverse the tide here, because they didn't want Nashville to be doing that. And so, you know, it can go wrong, but this is a problem that is, you know, largely in blue states. And also, when you're talking about trying to coordinate these regional interests, you don't want it to just be this hodgepodge of localities trying to engage one another in a planning process. You want the state to be convening them and in doing that. At the same breath, though, like, incentivizing localities is also good, since they do have final authority, at least is how we've currently constructed these laws in terms of making these zoning changes. And a lot of the times there's not, you know, we're not trying to get them to do a bunch of intentional planning. We just want them to just remove restrictions that currently exist and allow for developers and affordable housing developers and nonprofit developers to just do what they do best, which is go to places and figure out where it makes sense to build housing or to refurbish housing and just do it. You know, I don't think anyone here thinks that the best way for housing to get built is for the government to sit here and say, well, look at a map. Like, I guess we can put 10 here and like 12 there. Like, no, like, I think individuals have a better sense of where they want to live and what fits for their lifestyle and their community and like what views they like. And then those things are much more easily sorted out in a private market where there's some regulation, but not where there's clear central planning going on.
And before we go into our rapid fire, which is about that time, do you have a recommendation for our listeners if they're looking for states that have done a good job of sort of reaching down into the locality and affecting housing policy and or just superseding the locality entirely? Where would they look for a model law on that count?
Well, I wouldn't say there's an existing law where there's a model law anywhere in the United States, but California is the place where there has been the most action here because it's the place where housing prices have become the most onerous over a large geographical space. So you have people like especially Scott Wiener, who is a senator in state senator in California, who has proposed a number of bills. SB 50 from a couple of years ago is one that you can look up if you'd like. It did not pass, but it was a good model for what you could do at a statewide level. But what we've seen in California is that as the state has become kind of trying to preempt some of this local work, you know, localities have started to catch on to this. And we were seeing, I think now three different places in California that have eliminated single family only zoning within their boundary lines. And what that means is that there is no longer a ban on anything but a single family home within that state city's jurisdictions. What can be built is different in each place, whether it's duplexes or multiplexes or apartment buildings. Mm-hmm. But you can see that the political machinery of what's going on in the state level government really does affect how cities engage with their own policies.
Great. All right, Annie, you want to kick off our rapid fire?
Yeah. So, what was the last book, movie, and music recommendation you made to a friend or family member?
I have to do all three.
Book, movie.
All three. Book, music. Movie, and music.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, I think music is probably the easiest because I like everyone else, I've been listening to Taylor Swift re-recording her albums. I don't know if that's just too basic for everyone, but it's very good. I love it. And so
I would definitely that's too. The one.
Yeah.
Yes. She's six and then she's a Swiftie.
She's six. Yeah, exactly. Me too. And then movie, I'm going to cheat a little bit. I'm going to go TV show. I don't know if everyone's seen WandaVision, but I thought that was just absolutely spectacular. It's on Disney Plus. It is both if you're just like a TV buff, it's one of those TV movies like for people who love TV, like Community was. And on top of that, I think it's just a really sharp a depiction of what grief can do and how it can affect you and how you can affect other people when you fully start externalizing the harm that's and trauma that has occurred in your own life. So I think it's very, very good. It's very, very funny. And it's also like, I think a really, really good message. And then in terms of book, I probably the most recent recommendation that I've given is A Tree Grows in Brooklyn, which is, you know, it's a really good book about this girl who is an immigrant young girl who grows up in New York City. And it's a book that I read a lot when, you know, I immigrated to this country too. And I felt like I had a lot of in common with this girl. It's something that's like, you know, I would definitely recommend to young adult readers, something between 18 and 25. But if you read it at that age, even now, I think it's something that really sticks with you and shows a perspective that is not often there in literature. So
our next question is one of our favorite questions, which is, what is the most unpopular, benign opinion you hold? And another way that we say this is, what is the most insignificant hill you would be willing to die on?
Insignificant hill that I would be willing to die on? Wow. I feel like I'm not really doing the rapid fire part of this. I'm spending a lot of time.
No, it's fine. We call it rapid fire and it never is. So a long time ago, the co-founder of this podcast, she would tell everybody she doesn't like Game of Thrones, but that one's old now. Mine was that I don't like cake and I got to get a new one because I had really good cake and now I've changed my mind on that subject. But people have not liked Seinfeld. Other people have not liked pizza.
And really, nobody likes Game of Thrones anymore.
That's so funny. My probably my unpopular opinion is that pie is better than cake. And people really get angry when I say something like this, but it's just clearly better.
Yes.
And whether it's like fruit pie or like apple pie. And also on top of that, I do feel like apple pie and pumpkin pie should only be eaten in the fall. And that people who eat it outside of that, it's like very weird to me. It's just like,
all right, well, you and I are going to part ways there. I eat pie all year.
So if you pie, then what are you going to, what pie do you eat the rest of the year then?
Well, there's cherry pie.
Any kind of fruit pie. Fruit pie for the summer. Any kind of fruit pie for the summer.
Strawberry pie.
Yeah, you have chocolate. You could have key lime pie. Yeah, strawberry pie is great.
You can keep up with the seasons, Annie.
There's a lot
you just
pie.
Have the fruit as the seasons come.
Gotcha. Okay.
Although one of the things with pie is that it's stuff that's been preserved. So I don't know. It got me started on the pie thing, but I agree with you.
I mean, that'll work, and that made Tom really, really happy. He's like,
don't debate Jerusalem; you'll lose.
That's true. You're right. I'm not touching it. I will lose. next question is: what podcasts are you listening to right now?
I actually was just listening to Ezra Klein's podcast on anxiety. He just started it's just an episode on anxiety, but he has a multifaceted podcast that he does for the New York Times now. But this most recent one I think is really interesting. I think a lot of people especially over the last year, and I think just in general across American society, have reported a higher rate of intrusive thoughts and inability to stop worrying or, fixating on different problems or small things, and understanding the science behind it, and mindfulness, I think, is something that, has really been focused on in general. But I think it's a really good podcast, even though I think it's one of those things where you start thinking about something like this, and then you're like, oh, well, I'll just keep thinking about it. Like, so am I really solving the problem, or am I just continuing my fixation by listening to this podcast? But I do recommend it. It's very good.
Yeah, that one was excellent. I agree. Well, knowing that you are from Maryland, our question doesn't need any modification for you, which is, what is the best meal in Maryland? This is a meal that you need to be able to go out and get at a restaurant, and so it can't be a friend or family member that makes something for you.
It's Ethiopian food. I honestly, if you're in Silver Spring, if you're anywhere in Silver Spring and you can get Ethiopian food, you should go ahead and do it immediately. I am Ethiopian, so I am extremely biased in this place, but I also think that I'm just correct. I mean, the largest Ethiopian diaspora in the world is in the DC area, and so it is the best place outside of Ethiopia for you to be getting this kind of food. So if you're in the area, you should go do that.
What's the restaurant? Which place would you send people to?
Oh my gosh. I feel like I could, I have so many family members. I'm like kind of worried to say like a single restaurant, but I'm going to go ahead and say Duke M, which is before Ethiopic, which is, yeah. If someone hasn't tried it before, I think Ethiopic is a good place to kind of start it. It's a place that's kind of built for to let you try a bunch of different kinds of the main course dishes, and also it's a little bit American fusion. But Dukem is very, very good. Karen, which is in is very, very good. And honestly, if you were to walk down the street of Georgia Avenue in Silver Spring, there are 5 or 6 restaurants that are phenomenal that you can go grab a bite at.
Awesome.
So I guess the last question that we ask is one, it's named, it's basically the reason that this podcast kind of exists. It is, what do you think that we need to do to elevate Maryland?
I think I'm going to stick with my lane here. I think that, housing policy is something that is really, really important, and it's something that you can have a lot of effect on as a local individual. But I think the biggest thing here is that we're at a cusp moment here where this can become one of these sticking points between the really progressive far left and then individuals who are more moderate Democrats. And the way that we make sure that doesn't happen is that we don't alienate people with the message that we come at this with. If you say, like, if you go to your neighborhood meeting or you're talking to your family member who has a home and, you know, they're opposing an apartment building in their house, calling them a racist or telling them that they're, you know, going to, they're wrong for opposing this and they have no reason to feel this way is not the best way to be engaged in these conversations. There are a lot of good reasons that are in people's interest that you should engage people on. When talking about why they should want their communities to have more density, to be more diverse. And we've talked about them a lot in this episode, but making sure you're focusing on that. And also, I think just being really empathetic to the mindset that leads someone to have that much fear around their property values changing is really important. We have structured American society in a way where you need so much money to retire. Healthcare costs are so insane, especially for elderly Americans. So to the point where, you know, it is exceptionally rational to put all of your energy in making sure that nobody affects the appreciation of your largest asset. And understanding that's where a lot of people are coming from and meeting them there and explaining to them the reasons why you're going to be able to actually benefit economically from this exchange is really important. And it's a way that I think you're able to get more people there. So I think approaching people with that understanding and not just categorically casting them aside because they have this bad opinion is the only way to win, because I'm going to be very frank and honest with you. The majority of Americans, the dream for them is to become a homeowner. And when that happens, you're going to get a lot of these people switching over their opinions. You see it in a ton of polling. You become less likely to want more development, less likely to want multifamily housing or density near you once you become a homeowner. And that might be changing now with millennials, because a lot of us have rented for a long time or lived in multifamily units or lived along with our friends in row houses or whatever it is. But we can't count on that being the way that change happens. It has to happen with us convincing people to.
Well, great. Jerusalem, thank you so much for your writing. I have everything you write, I consume as soon as I see it come out. You're also a great presence on Twitter. But as someone who cares a lot about this issue and lives it, I think that you are a much needed voice. And thank you so much for coming on the show as well today.
Thank you so much. I loved being on.
All right, Annie, now we're going to switch over to our three things, which I appreciate you've brought two things to the table today, so I only have to do one. So what's your first one?
Well, my first one is the Derek Chauvin trial. It has been a tough year, having to watch that video over and over, having to watch what happened, seeing the emotion within our communities, seeing the pain. And when I say trial, I mean this year has been a trial for so many in so many ways, but that particular piece of this year has been very difficult for so many families. I want to also just talk about the fact that this trial would not have happened and ended the way it did if it weren't for a 17-year-old girl who videotaped this event. And she was there with her, I believe, her 9-year-old cousin. I mean, the trauma that has that started with this, that happened, and it, obviously it's systemic, it's something from before this, but the trauma that started with this particular event and then has gone from there on is it affects so many communities in so many ways. And I think for just knowing that if we didn't have this young woman who is a child, really, I mean, they're children, and they're watching this live in their neighborhoods. It's wrong. This shouldn't happen. And while I'm thankful for her, I can't understand how much trauma she's probably going through right now as well. It is not acceptable for children to have to go through this at all.
Yeah.
And so that for me has been, like I said, it's not that I'm happy about this, the trial ending the way it is. I think that there is a sense of justice, because there someone said to me recently, there's no justice in the justice system. And today is one day where it feels like maybe there's an ounce there, and that there's been one family that has received, that feels maybe that they've gotten some justice. Mm-hmm. And for them, I'm relieved, if anything else.
Yeah. You know, I've spent a lot of time today just thinking about what the verdict, what it means, mm-hmm. Because this was an egregious, egregious case.
Yeah.
And we were very, very worried it wasn't going to go the way it did.
Yeah.
And this is a system that enables people of color, Black men in particular, to be murdered by people under the color of law. The people with a badge can kill them, and more often than not, they are not going to be prosecuted. And if they are prosecuted, they're not going to be convicted. And so in some ways, and I hate to even look at it this way, but in some ways, even this verdict is part of the tragedy, because it is just so egregious, and yet it was still felt close. And there's no, it's not, it doesn't change the system. Right. It doesn't change the fact that right now there is probably someone that is being unfairly manhandled, receiving violence from a police officer because of the color of their skin. Yeah. And, you know, it's just, it takes so much to look at the whole system. But I do think that because it is so rare to get these outcomes, it does take some reflection, and maybe not celebration is the word, but certainly appreciation for the accountability, appreciation for that young woman, appreciation for Attorney General Keith Ellison, who said he was not going to let this stand, and appreciation for those jurors who, man, you know, you get jury duty, you don't think it's going to be for a case like that. I'm glad that you highlighted this. My thing that I'm thinking about is the gubernatorial field is beginning to fill up. I think the last time we recorded, we had one candidate in the race, Peter Francho, or maybe one, there was another millionaire fella who's running. And I don't mean disrespect. I just do not know his name.
Ashwin Jain maybe is running as well.
Maybe that was it. But then since that point, now we have Rashern Baker, who has entered the race. Dr. John King, friend of the show, has entered the race. I think that the county executive candidates or potential candidates are all waiting to finish their budget cycle before they make their decision. You know, I just want to take a moment to say it is so rough being a county executive and being an elected official. And I know I'm making those two things distinct, but I'm doing that on purpose, because the county executive is just such an all-consuming job in ways that is just not applicable for the legislative branch. And all due respect to our friends in the legislature, but the county executive's role is, it just takes up your whole life, 7 days a week, 14 hours a day. And then amidst that, you've got these other people who are shooting into the race all around you. And maybe it's a race that you think that you'd be a good candidate for. Yeah. And the race just starts filling up with folks. And so I'm very empathetic to our county executive, Calvin Ball, who should be in these discussions. I do not understand why there are discussions of who will be running for governor that includes Stuart Pittman, respect to him, but not Calvin Ball. So he should be in the discussion. Johnny O obviously has been in the discussion. Angela Alsobrooks, she will be in the discussion. I don't think we're going to have many county executives in the race, because these county executives came in and they have, they're finishing their first term now. So any of them who run for governor would be giving up a safe seat to try to get through a primary, and then please God beat whatever Republican comes out of the other side. But you know, they deserve consideration. They deserve respect. So that's my view on the gubernatorial field.
Yeah, no, I think it's good. We do have so many good possibilities, good candidates that are running. I noticed that there's maybe one Republican running right now. So that's
right. Kelly Schultz.
Schultz, yeah.
And listen, I know I was a little flippant there. I've heard nothing but great things about Kelly Schultz, but I think the problem is, and I apologize for interrupting, I'll be quick, but the problem is that we have experienced 8 years of conservative policies in relation to the demands of equity, and that has not been a good formula.
I definitely think I don't want to see another Republican in the governor's office in 2022. That's definitely how I feel. But
yeah.
But speaking of women running, I know that Walter Mondale recently passed. He passed away the other night, and he was vice president to Jimmy Carter from 1976 to 1980. I'm not going to say when I was born. We're not going to talk about that. But we will say that I remember him running for president. And he was the kind of guy who, when he was vice president, he shaped the vice presidency in a way that was very different than it had been in the past. And that is kind of what gave him the ability to run for president. I mean, he ran against Reagan. Reagan was doing great. He only won his state and I think DC, and that was it. But his shining achievement in that moment was that he was the first person of a major ticket of a major party to choose a woman as his vice president. And that moment is what actually changed my view. As a kid, I remember thinking it's just, you know, it's people, it's men. It's people who run for office are men. And when I saw that, when I saw Geraldine Ferraro up on that stage with him, that for me has been, it was a life-changing moment. And I was very young. I was very young at the time, but, it completely changed me as a person. I know it changed the country. And it allowed us to be where we are today, which is where we have a male president, but we have a female vice president now. And for that, I think he definitely deserves kudos for a lot of the things that he did in his lifetime. But that is one that I personally am very thankful for.
That is such a cool story. I cannot add to that at all, other than to say, I think often of the things that my daughter sees and the presumptions that are put before her that are subconscious. And I will say, as a white male, so much of our archetype is based off of subconscious assumptions, and in some cases, conscious assumptions that block out everybody else.
Yeah.
And so I love that story because, again, you know, I don't like people say, well, what if it was your daughter or what if it was your sister? Like, no, you should care about the equality of all people, whether or not you have daughters. However, having a daughter brings it into stark contrast because I want everything in the world for my kids.
Yeah.
And so I love the story that you told simply because it confirms that these things matter so much more than we can ever imagine. It matters so much more than electoral success or how the populace is going to respond to it. It matters in huge psychological ways and cultural ways that we might never consider.
Yeah. Yeah.
Exactly. All right, Annie. Well, this was a wonderful show. I'm so glad we were able to get another one of my, I do have to apologize to Candace because she did say, and Candace, if you're listening, I might have stuck one past the goalie. You did say not too many of these housing people in a row, but now I'm good. Now I've got it all out of my system for a month or so. But I obviously think housing is critically important, and I know you do too. So this was a fun show.
I mean, I have a couple of people on my wish list, so I'll send those over to you as well if you'd like.
Good. Yeah, let's do it.
Adam Server is one of them. He's amazing, and I'd love
Who's this?
Adam Server.
Oh, okay, cool. All right, we'll do it.
Well,
all right, Annie, you have a good night.
Yep, you too. Thank you.